This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is being brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used to manage personal injury, medical malpractice, MDL, class action law firms all over the United States. Great program, highly recommend it. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. Today's episode is being brought to you by Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the place to go for everything involving experts to help you win your case. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. And today's episode is being brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a one-stop shop for all of your digital marketing needs. Check them out at hypelegal.com. Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Ben Gideon. Raul is off this week. He's actually on a flight to Miami as we speak to surprise his mom for her birthday. And he was a little worried because he told me his mom isn't the kind of person who always likes surprises. So we'll see how that goes for him and he can report back next episode. And I am recording from home today because there's a big milestone in my life, which is that at 10 a.m. I will be leaving here to go pick up my daughter from high school and to take her for her driver's test. She'll be going for her license today, which is our third to do that. But she's very nervous and excited for that. And I hope she passes because if not, we're never going to hear the end of it. Scott, do you have any kids who have had gone for their license?
I have little kids. I've got an 8 and a 5-year-old. So I haven't even thought about that world right now. We're just working on Mr. Beast and Pot and YouTube and all that kind of stuff. So I'm not there yet.
Well, you have that to look forward to. What you'll find, as we have, is that it is a real blessing for your children to get their driver's license and become self-sufficient. So your decade of carting them around will come to an end.
I look forward to those days.
So it's my pleasure to welcome Scott Perry to the podcast today. Scott is a trial lawyer from the state of Virginia, has many, many large verdicts, and I'm sure we'll get into talking about some of them today. He's also a member of the Inner Circle of Advocates, only one of two lawyers from the state of Virginia in the Inner Circle. So welcome, Scott.
Thanks, Ben. I really appreciate being here. Thank you for having me.
So I'm interested to learn about your background. Now, first of all, are you a military guy?
No, I'm not. You might see it in the background there. That's my grandfather who fought in the Battle of the Bulge, but I am not.
All right. So I just assume, I guess, everyone from Virginia was his former military or something.
Well,
so tell us, you're a trial lawyer. You had your own firm for a while, more recently joined Jeffrey Bright and his firm, which is one of the top plaintiff's firms in Virginia. But give us your kind of life story in a nutshell to the point where you are today as an accomplished trial lawyer.
Well, thanks, Ben. I'm a Jersey guy through and through, born and raised. And I always kid that I'm the only one in my family that's left. And came down to law school in D.C. And I always knew I wanted to be a trial lawyer, but I didn't really know what that meant. I guess probably true of a lot of us in the beginning.
Why is that something you knew you wanted to be?
I loved the concept of, honestly, it sounds trite, but the David versus Goliath. One person in front of six, or in Virginia, it's seven jurors, getting to tell their story. And I was fascinated by it. And then I did a clerkship in what's called D.C. Superior Court, but that's the trial court in Washington, D.C. And it was actually a criminal clerkship, which I knew I couldn't do criminal law, or didn't want to, I should say. But it was fascinating watching those lawyers go against each other. I mean, really good lawyers on really difficult murder cases and things like that. But as I would imagine, some of us are in that situation. I had giant law school loans and I said, okay, now what do I do? And so after my clerkship, I joined a giant 1,000 lawyer law firm here in DC. And I spent 7 years there. I wasn't miserable, but I knew it wasn't what I was going to do. But the real story is I was defending product liability cases. And it's the only time I've been on the defense when I was at a big firm. And I loved it. But I also saw the people on the other side. They seemed to be having a lot more fun. It was a lot more creative. And I was like, wow, this is really cool. And so I had a decision to make. Right around that time, I had met my wife. We didn't have kids. And I got put up for partner, which was something I was proud about. And as you can guess, the salary at a big law firm was enticing to a 31-year-old kid guy. But my wife and I talked about it. And I said, you know what? If I don't leave now and try this, I'm never going to do it. And so long story short, I joined a small med mal firm in DC run by a lawyer who is my mentor and still my idol today, a guy named Bruce Clores, who was sort of the dean of medical malpractice in DC. That's sort of how it got started. I started as an associate with Bruce, and I didn't know a medical malpractice case from a car accident case. And it's a different world, medical malpractice. And so he threw me right in. And I'll never forget my first $1 million verdict, which was back in, I guess it was 2009. He let me try a case in Virginia by myself. The doctor, he's since deceased, but it was a hysterectomy where they cut the ureter. And I'll never forget this. I go to the deposition and the doctor says to me on the record, "You're making a big mistake suing me." And you don't want to do this. And I'm like, shit, man, I don't know what I'm doing here yet. It's like intimidating me. But I tried that case, and I'll tell you what happened. It was a funny little war story. Got a nice verdict for this wonderful woman. She was a government worker all her life, single woman, never married, ended up with a colostomy. And I'm all excited about my big verdict, first verdict ever. And I get a defense motion for a new trial. And this is 2009. So Facebook is alive, but not as ubiquitous as it is now. And the motion is that several jurors were speaking with each other on Facebook. And we're thinking, okay, well, what does this mean? So we go in, and I know enough about Facebook that I said to the judge, we had a very pro-defense judge. I said, "Judge, how did they find this information out?" And all of a sudden, the defense gets really quiet. And it turns out that the representative of the insurance company had pretended she was someone else and friended these jurors on Facebook during the trial.
Wow.
And started talking to them. "Hey, what do you think? What do you think?" So basically, she got it going as the one that got to talk.
Jeez.
And I'll never forget this judge who, like I said, she's now a great mediator, but very pro-defense generally. And she looks at the defense attorney, and I won't use his name. I'll say Mr. Jones. And she says, "Mr. Jones, I'm going to give you 10 minutes. You're going to walk outside and you guys are going to resolve this case immediately or something's going to happen here." And we did, to their credit. But it was fascinating to me. And the trial is one aspect, but there's all this other stuff that goes on there that goes along with it. So that was an interesting experience, that's for sure.
That is interesting. I mean, that's a tough lesson to have to confront after your first big verdict and the worry that it might get taken away because of misconduct. I had a case like that once where post-verdict, the defense had a orchestrated effort to try to take the verdict away, and they hired somebody who went to the jurisdiction and started knocking on the doors of the jurors' homes, invited some of them out for pizza and beer, and ultimately got one of the 13 jurors, there were 13 in that case, to sign an affidavit stating that he had done something, looked something up on the internet or something. And when I researched the person who did that, I found that they had given a seminar at a DRE conference on how to overturn verdicts after the verdict. So
wow,
there's definitely an industry out there and strategies that they will use to do that. So we all have to be particularly careful about it.
Yeah.
So going back to your decision to leave, are you willing to share what firm you were at? I'm just curious because I had the same kind of path myself. I was at a big firm and left.
And I had a good experience here. It's just Oreck. It was Oreck, Herrick, Harrington, and Sutcliffe.
Right.
Based in San Fran, but I was always in their DC office.
That takes a lot of guts to leave a firm like that when you're on the cusp of making partner, because that's sort of the, you've made it at that point in that world, and you're almost assured to have a secure career with high income, fairly low risk, if you continue to play the game, but you chose not to do that and to really go out and do something that was much more risky for you personally. I suspect we have listeners that may be in that same position right now and are weighing the risks and benefits of those kind of choices. Can you talk a little bit about how you came to that decision?
Yeah. And coincidentally, I just met this week with a young lawyer in DC who's confronting the situation. And I'll tell you the other thing, Ben, that's I would say has even made it harder now is when I heard the salary that this kid is, he's a kid, you know, he's 28 years old.
I'm curious what they're paying people now.
Associates making $350,000, $400,000. So yeah, I mean, look, I grew up middle class and it was never about money for me, but quite frankly, I wanted to do well. But I just said to myself that, can I really do this for the rest of my life where I sit and I'm fourth chair at a deposition? And the way these large firms work, you know this, it works for them, but there's really only one or two people that can try a case, I swear, at those firms, right? Everybody else is what I call a litigator, which is very different than a trial attorney, right? And I just, like I said, I remember having these conversations with my wife where I said, look, I don't know where this is going to end, but if I don't try it, I'm going to regret it. And I will tell you, there were lean years, believe me, because I sort of skipped over the maybe the most important part, which is that when I first met with Bruce, and I'm sure we've all done this, and Bruce and I laugh about it now, I took him out to lunch. I didn't know who he was, or he didn't know who I was. This is the Med Malware I joined. And, you know, it was one of these, oh, I'm just having lunch. Well, of course, I wanted a job. And I thought it went great, and I didn't hear from him for a year. And then I said, oh, man, now what have I done? Because I'm leaving the firm, and I don't have a job. And then I sort of puttered around trying to figure it out. And then a year later, I get a call from Bruce. But even then, I mean, I'll tell you the other struggle we have, and I don't know if you face this too, Ben, is, again, the salaries that associates make that plaintiff's law firms can pay is quite different. But going back to your question, I believe in passion. I believe you have to love what you do. And I just said to myself, there is just no way that I can't try this. And I joined a firm, so I had somewhat of a protection. But I know people that go out on their own, and that's really impressive.
Yeah.
But that was sort of how I got there.
Yeah, that's interesting. I had a similar experience, which is that I was at a big firm in New York City, Latham & Watkins, although like you, it was based out of California,
sure.
An LA-based firm. And I was a fifth-year associate there. And I liked it, like you described. I think I learned a lot there. I developed a lot of good relationships. I had a bunch of good, I guess, career building types of experiences and learned a lot. But ultimately, it just wasn't the life I wanted. And I saw what the partner's life looked like. And it wasn't, their life wasn't the life I wanted either.
Right.
And I thought, I'd love to try my hand at getting into the courtroom and trying cases. However, I don't know if I'm going to be any good at that or not, because I haven't done it. And
right.
But if I don't try it now, I'm never going to do it. So I might as well try. And if I fail, I fail. And then I can move on from there and do something different.
Right.
But at least I won't live my whole life wondering what if. I feel like you kind of were in that same place.
Yeah.
When you made that decision and moved into trying cases, was there something about your personality or past experience that where you thought, I'm going to be good at this, I have the skill set, personality to succeed? Or were you, like me, equally uncertain about it when you started?
No, 100%. And I'll tell you the other thing, probably shouldn't admit this, but I will. You know, I have a big chip on my shoulder. I went to a third-tier law school. I was an average student. And I kind of loved going against these Harvard and Yale guys. And I'm impressed by them, don't get me wrong. But at the end of the day, the best part about the jury system is you really just need to be able to talk to people, right? And, you know, it's funny you asked me about military in the back, in the beginning. I'm not military, but my grandfather is my idol. He's long gone. But he's an Irish Catholic guy, throw back beers at a bar and tell stories like nobody else. And if there's one thing I've learned doing this now 25 years is, and this is certainly not coming from me, right? We've got all the books behind us, but it's all about telling stories. And I like telling stories. And so, no, I certainly didn't have that confidence at all. But I did think that I could just talk to people. And to me, that's what this really boils down to. But I will tell you, there's trial, right? Which is the most exciting thing in the world. But then, as you know, 90% of the time is spent in the trenches, right? And I'll never forget the first big deposition that Bruce let me take. I had studied hours and I had my outline. I'd read a question, he'd answer, I'd move to the next question. And at one point, Bruce stops the deposition and says, we're going to take a break. And I'm thinking, oh, I'm kicking this guy's ass, right? And he takes me outside and he grabs me by the shoulders and he says, put the outline away. And I said, what are you talking about? He says, he's giving you information and you're not following up because you're so concerned about getting through your 20-page outline. And that's when I realized it's just as much about listening as it is preparation, which is important, particularly with in the medical field, because the medicine is the medicine, but there's often that sort of in between of the interaction between the doctor and the patient or the hospital and trying to figure out what really went on.
And you started out doing medical malpractice cases, which are certainly, I think, widely considered among the hardest kinds of plaintiff's cases to do. Is that an area that you like and think you're well suited to? And what is it about those kind of cases that you like?
So I'll tell you the truth. I like them very much, but my decision about a year ago to join forces with Jeff Bright had a lot to do with it. And that's because one of the things, and this is what's so fascinating, is every state is so different in the law. And medical malpractice in Virginia, I think we're one of two states that has a total damages cap. So there's a cap on economic damages. Which people are always like, how is that possible? And I still don't understand how our Virginia Supreme Court has twice held that constitutional. But the reality is, just being blunt, as I started getting better and getting bigger and bigger verdicts, I got more and more frustrated because you can get the biggest verdict in the world in Virginia and they say, thank you very much. That's a great verdict. Here's your $2.5 million to give to the patient, which sounded like a lot of money in the early days. Right, for the patient who was injured. But you know, I mean, if you have a catastrophic injury, I mean, I had a case last year with a $14 million life care plan in Virginia that they did not dispute, and that case was worth $2.5 million.
Wow.
And so the truth is, you can only fight City Hall for so long. Virginia's cap has been in place for 40 years. And I finally just said to my wife, I said, look, I'm banging my head against the wall doing MedMal in Virginia. And one of the reasons, the main reason I joined Jeff is he does non-MedMal stuff, and it gave me access to those different types of cases that are not capped. So yeah, I love medical malpractice, but I've also found that it's, tiring is the right word. I mean, there's no such thing as a small MedMal case.
I can't imagine trying to do a MedMal case with an overall cap like that, because there's just no exposure or risk on the other side. And they... even when there's no cap, they battle these things to the death. But it's that risk of the upward exposure that ultimately, if the case is going to resolve, is the driving force behind that. And you don't have that to hold over them. So I'm sure there's a lot of very emboldened and brash defense lawyers who are pounding their chest and acting tough in a world where they really have no risk, right? And that must be extremely frustrating to deal with that.
It is. Now, I get along with most of them now. You know, I deal with them. Bruce used to get so frustrated, and he'd say the best trial job in the world is to be a defense med mal lawyer in Virginia. Because if you have no risk of exposure to an excess verdict, of course you're going to be confident in trying the case. The flip side, I always tell young lawyers, if you really want to try cases, come to Virginia for med mal, because they try it. So many more of them here, again, because there's no excess verdict risk. So yeah, and it's, anyway, I could get into caps forever. And non-economic caps, that's one thing. But economic caps, where you have a life care plan and wage loss, it's crazy.
Yeah, you said there's only two states with that. What's the other
one? My understanding that...
I just want to know where else to avoid.
Where not to go.
Yeah.
Right? Indiana. My understanding is Indiana.
Yeah. Well, I probably wasn't heading there anytime soon anyway.
Right.
So tell me about this case where you represented the 18-year-old Filipino that was injured in a rowing incident. That sounds pretty fascinating.
It is. And I'll tell you, it's the case that changed my life. It was about 3 years after joining Bruce doing medical malpractice. And that's all he did. But Bruce really cares about his people. And we had these Filipino clients come in. The typical story, they were immigrants here, very religious, living the American dream, came here speaking no English, and their two older children, their three kids, both had become medical doctors through just sheer fortitude. And the youngest son was no doubt headed in that direction. And one of the things that was really important to them was community service. And so the 18-year-old son would come home from college and he would teach rowing to kids out on the Potomac River, which is essentially our local river here in D.C.
I've heard of it.
You heard of it, right? Yeah. Well, what's funny you say that is, so I couldn't tell you a rowboat from a jet ski at that point. And I certainly didn't know anything about rowing. And this is one of the things I love about what we do, because I ended up becoming like an expert on rowing and everything else. But what had happened to this boy, and I have to keep some of it confidential, but essentially he was in the coaching boat and had hit sort of a weird turn, and he got thrown into the water and ultimately drowned. And what was fascinating to me is the first question everybody asked was, well, he's a good swimmer. Well, this kid was a big muscular kid and he was a great swimmer. But this is when so then you start talking to experts, and I learned about this concept of laryngeal reflux drowning, where your body just shocks and it literally closes your throat, which is a safety mechanism, right, to keep the water from coming in. But what can happen is you can panic and he drowned.
Is that from the cold water, or is it just because of the shock of getting thrown out of the boat, or both?
Combination of both, right? And so this family was just devastated, and Bruce said, we have to take this case. Now, neither of us knew anything about rowing or anything, but we started to talk to some experts, and what I found out, and again, I won't use names, but in European countries, the coaches were required to wear life jackets at all times, and they had a switch. You've probably seen it on an elliptical machine that unfortunately nobody uses, right? That you can hook to your wrist so that if you fall off, it shuts down the elliptical. Same thing with these boats, and it would shut down the engine. And what we found out is, and this was just how I love what we do, I started just Googling. I found this old guy in Europe who was formerly an American rower, had moved to Europe. And he said, oh, I got a story for you. I said, tell me your story. And his story was that for years he had been warning and saying, hey, we have got to put these safety mechanisms in place. Like in Europe, somebody's going to die. And he starts giving me these emails that he has sent to the defendant. So we ended up taking the case on. And the other thing, again, what I love about being a trial lawyer, so I start researching it. I'm a med mal lawyer in DC. DC is not ocean going. And I look at it and I go, Bruce, this is a maritime law case because the Potomac River is a navigable waterway. Well, I didn't even know what that meant, right? So I file a maritime case in DC Superior Court where they've never had one, I don't think. And we went from there. But ultimately, they fought that case like the Dickens. But the cool thing about that case, the way it ended up, is that when we finally overcame summary judgment, we reached a resolution. And one of the things we did, which was so cool, is that at the boathouse on the Potomac where this took place, they put up a plaque and has his name, and it lists all the safety rules that were going to go into effect. And this is one of those cases, and I'm sure you've had it. The insurance money was not great because this was a small rowing organization, but that plaque meant everything to that family. And once we went down and saw that plaque up there, it was like, how can you do better than that? Obviously, I can never bring your son back. And they could care less about money. Money wasn't going to change that. And again, it was this concept of this Filipino family that comes here, has no power, no political clout. And the idea that they could make this big organization, because ultimately we got to the national organization, make these changes. To me, that's what being a trial lawyer is about. And that was just such a great experience. Way more than any big verdict I've ever gotten, because this is, you see that look on that mom's face when she sees that plaque, forget it.
We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno, national court reporting service that allows trial lawyers to defer the costs of court reporting until the end of the case. Take a look, steno.com. And by Law Pods. Law Pods is the podcast production company that we use to produce the show, that produces podcasts for lawyers all over the country. They have an expertise in podcasting and the law. Check them out at lawpods.com. And has the national organization changed their safety protocols now so that folks wear life jackets and have the emergency shut off or whatever that is?
They actually do.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, that was cool. You don't get to do that often, I find.
Yeah, that's a great story. I mean, it sounds like a really hard case. And I heard you talk about another case that when I first heard you explain it, sounded impossible, and you ended up getting a great result in it. The one involving the young man who was going with his high school group to do the bamboo clearing. Do you want to talk a little bit about that one? That's another one where the facts are quite unusual.
Yeah.
And if you heard the story from a potential client who walked through your door and gave you the kind of a 60-second overview of that, I think a lot of lawyers would say that's probably not a case or one that I want to, you know, do. But you managed to turn that into a good case and a great result. Can you share that one with?
Oh, thank you. Well, it's funny. So since the Rowan case, I sort of have developed this weird specialty of, like, I call sports injury cases, but, you know, significant ones. And this one came in through my new partner, Kevin Biniazin, and was a young kid raised in poverty in a city in Virginia who was an awesome basketball player. And he got the opportunity to play high school basketball at this amazing private school outside of Charlottesville, Virginia, that just looks like a fortress when I saw it. And again, they do community service projects. And generally speaking, these projects are painting benches and raking leaves and what have you. But they had a new director come in, and he decided that he was going to have them cut bamboo at a local bamboo, I guess, forest near the VFW hall. And this poor guy, let me jump to what happened. He went into the bamboo forest, didn't know what he was doing, and ultimately slipped and became impaled through his rectum on a spear of bamboo that literally, it's like something you see in a movie. It went through his rectum and came out the front. And he survived incredibly, but he had been rendered slightly, if that's a word, incontinent. But most important to us is he was infertile and couldn't have children.
Although that issue was disputed, wasn't it, by the defense?
It was hugely disputed, yeah. Ultimately, when we started looking at the case, we realized that this is one of those cases where those kids just never should have been there. Because, of course, the defense was freak accident and these things can happen. And that was originally our approach to the case was, well, what was specifically happening at the time when he fell and all that. And then every once in a while, and I have to remind myself, I don't know if you have this feeling, sometimes you get into the weeds, no pun intended, in a case, and you say, wait a second, I'm looking at this wrong. And we realized when we back channeled it, okay, maybe it's a freak accident, but why were they there in the first place, right? And then we started getting into the discovery, and we had found out that they had done no preparation. They didn't have approval to be there. And I'll tell you something else, Ben, that fascinated me. You know, I've become a big fan of jury research only recently, to be honest with you. And I'm a father with young kids, and I sort of took the perspective that teacher was doing the best they could. Are you going to be able to really hold them responsible? When we jury focused group it, the jurors, the focus group, went nuts and said, you put your child in their stead. This was a boarding school. You're the parents. You should have never let them be there. And so I felt more confident at that point that we could hold them liable. The one thing I will say too, that we've talked a little bit about this in the inner circle, we entered into a high-low agreement on this case, which most of our listeners will know what that is, but it's basically an agreement whereby which you get a verdict within the low or the high range, the verdict is collected. If the verdict is above that, you get the high number. If the verdict is below that or a defense verdict, you get the low number. It worked really well, and I'll tell you why. In this case, in Virginia, we still have charitable immunity, and we had won that at the trial level, but we were really worried about it at the appellate level. And we were able to insulate ourselves from a clearly appellate issue that the appeals court was going to look at really carefully. And so ultimately, the verdict actually fell right in the middle of the high-low agreement. We got a $10 million verdict. And the other thing about that was, it was shocking for me because that was my first one since joining this firm. And it's all non-economic damages, which in the MedMal case would have said, here's your $2 million and walk away. But we were able to collect. And the great news is that this kid has made an incredible recovery. He's actually now playing college basketball, and he's got the infertility issue, but he's making a life out of it.
When you presented on the case, I think you opened up with footage of him playing basketball, and everybody was assuming that the punchline would be, he can't do this anymore, that this is how he was before the incident. And then you started out by explaining that this was from after he was injured, as I recall.
Yeah.
Which is, first of all, you've clearly learned something about how to present your case to lawyers. So I like that.
Right.
Lowering expectations. We used to do that at my old firm, where we had this lunchtime activity where it was sort of, what is this case worth? And you'd go around the table. And
right.
The goal was to state a number that was clearly lower and then impress everybody that you had exceeded that, right?
You gotta hire. Right.
But the new people would be like, oh, that's $10 million, you know, or whatever the pie in the sky number was. And you'd have to gradually explain to them that that's not the goal of the game. It's to make to lower expectations.
Just a funny side story about that. With my new firm, we do something similar. And my partners have stopped talking to me because I say every case is worth $2.5 million because that's the maximum you can ever recover. And they're like, this is a $10 million case. I'm like, $2.5 million.
In that case, I mean, the thing that I thought was, and interested in your juror research into that, because the part of that that I found to be hardest when I heard the fact pattern was that usually you're looking for some bad actor where you can characterize them as doing something evil in a certain way, maybe for a profit motive, maybe based on,
yep,
if it's a medical case, maybe it's hubris or arrogance or just not spending the time or whatever the underlying kind of bigger picture issue is that explains the wrongdoing and makes it dangerous in an activity that people are going to worry about can be affect them perhaps, or be repeatable and dangerous more broadly. And in your case, my initial thought was, you know, you're suing a school and teachers who are there to educate kids. They don't, like you said, they're a charitable organization, at least on paper. And none of them are probably making hedge fund manager money. And
right,
they probably are good people when you get to know them, and caring people.
Absolutely.
And then to top it off, they're involved in a community service project at the time of the incident. So how do you get the kind of moral force behind that in a way that would motivate jurors? But you clearly were able to do that, and your research demonstrated that for that case, there was something about that that was motivating to jurors. Can you explain what you learned about that?
Yeah, and you're 100% right. And those were all the fears I had. And I can tell you, every teacher witness was like somebody you'd write in a storybook. It was nobody to hate in this case. Yeah, so that was my fear. And it was actually one of the reasons we spent the time on the juror research. What we found that I didn't know and is how incredibly dangerous bamboo can be and is. And we had presented or had learned that back in Vietnam, it was used as weapons. And once we realized the level of the danger, we then talked about or looked into, okay, well, what preparation did you do to confront the danger? And so there were no bad actors in this case. There was nobody that you wouldn't like. But what we realized as we looked at the case is that they had done absolutely no preparation for this event, for this community service project. And so what we did through our witnesses, and in fact, we debated this for a long time, we actually hired, and I think it ultimately turned out to be a huge plus for us, somebody who cuts bamboo for a living.
It just proves that there's an expert on any topic one can identify.
That's true. And I'm not kidding you, Ben. We started with the opening statement. There is a magazine, I think it's called Bamboo Life.
No, there isn't.
He's on the cover, right? Oh, I swear. It was hysterical.
All right.
But he was our very first witness out of the box because he talked nothing about what happened in this case. He just talked about how dangerous bamboo is if it's not handled by professionals. And the concept was, if we build that level of danger and then come in with, what did you do to prepare for this? And the answer is nothing. We thought we could thread that needle. Now, I will say the part that scared me throughout the case, and we got lucky, as you know, you want the danger to be something that the juror sitting there feels like he or she confront, right? And who's ever going to be in a bamboo forest cutting bamboo? So that was the part that scared me. But again, what the jury research taught me was, once you put your children in somebody else's control and they say, we got this, we're going to take care of them, the expectation of the person, the parent, is high. And so we wanted parents on that jury, and we wanted them to sit there and think, damn, I send my kid to summer camp, and I assume that they know they're not supposed to be doing this and that. And so I think that's the way we were able to do it, but it was tough because there was no bad actor in this case, in the sense of a villain.
So your jury research and profiling suggested that you wanted parents was there any other profile that fit for a good juror in that case?
So this was one of those that surprised me. I don't really pay a lot of attention to conservative versus liberal jurors. I don't really feel that makes that much difference. But they were finding that conservative jurors that identified themselves as conservative were better jurors on this case because the fact that they are individualists, the feeling was you can't put someone into a situation and give them no tools to perform the activity. And if you do that, you're responsible for the result. So that kind of surprised me because I think of conservatives as more sort of, let me go out there and just do it on my own and we get what we get. But we found that. And what's interesting, the other thing about Charlottesville, it was tried in Charlottesville, Virginia. We were a little concerned, you know, our client was African-American. It's a very white jury pool. Although we did end up with a pretty fairly evenly mixed jury. But I will tell you that to follow on your point, when we spoke to the jurors afterwards, six of the seven were convinced on liability, but that one was, they really had to work hard on her to get her on liability. So it clearly was the issue.
Yeah, it's really fascinating and also illustrates that often our own instincts or intuitions can really be wrong. And so it's helpful to check that by some form of juror research, even if that's some informal polling of people that aren't lawyers that do this for a living or doing the more formal jury research type things that we're doing now. But more and more, I find that to be the case. I mean, in Med-Mal cases now, apparently it's quite common that conservative jurors can be better for you, but depending on the type of case and what venue you're in. So
I went to a CLE a number of years ago, and I'll never forget this. As you know, a lot of CLEs are not that helpful. And I don't remember who the speaker was, but I'll never forget what she said. She said, and it was a bunch of plaintiff's lawyers, and she said, how many of you in here listen to Rush Limbaugh every day? Maybe one hand went up out of 50. How many of you drive Buicks? No hands went up. And she said, well, that's your problem because those are your jurors. And that was like a light bulb though, right? Because I was like, wow, we're not thinking the way they're thinking. It was interesting to me.
Yeah, that is fascinating. So going back and thinking through your progression over the course of your career doing plaintiff's work and trying cases and maybe talking to folks who were just getting started or trying to refine their approach and their skills, are there things that you've found that have been particularly valuable to you, either your own practices, approach to preparation, mentors or books you rely on? What are the things, the big principles that you can impart on others who are trying to emulate your success in this field?
The first answer is I'm always learning. And anybody who thinks that they've reached their expert point, I think is probably wrong. I'm constantly reading new books. You know, I like psychology books perhaps more than the law books because, excuse me, I think that they don't have a bias toward them. But I'll tell you, my practice changed when I realized, I mentioned this earlier, the concept of storytelling, which, you know, certainly doesn't come from me. But in medical malpractice, to begin with, and you know this, Ben, I mean, it's complex, difficult issues where the actor almost never intended to do anything. And I was getting really deep into the medicine, into these trials, and I could see I was losing the jurors. And so the concept of storytelling really became important to me when I realized that almost every complex piece of medicine can be explained in a non-complex way. And it was interesting because that drew that parallel back to my grandfather, who could tell a story about a moral or that just snapped in your head and you realized it. And so we had a big, in 2019, right? It was right before COVID. I had a big neurosurgery case. It was a doctor who had stuck a tool through the iliac artery, and our client, she lived, but in a terribly disabled way. And we were knee deep in the trial, and it was complex, and they had the American Society of Neurosurgeon president and all of that. I looked at my co-counsel and I said, we are losing them. And so in closing argument, he showed a picture of I'll never forget, there's an apple, a banana, and an orange, which just approximated the structures that we were talking about. And we showed that there was no way the defense claimed this could be a slip. Our theory was he didn't know where he was. And we showed that there was just, I said, you try to put a knife through the apple, the banana, and the orange and come out the other side using the amount of force he was using, and you can't do it. And we got a really nice verdict on that case. And I realized while the medicine is important and we had to present all the complex evidence, concepts that we all know, that we all understand, can turn on that light bulb. That's one thing. The other thing that I will say is looking for the right witness. In that case, we had, I don't know, 8 experts and God knows what they got paid and they all did their job. But the husband said, you need to talk to our home health aide, the woman who comes into our house every day and is paid by Medicaid. And I went and met with this woman, heavy set Jamaican woman, real thick accent, loved her from the beginning. And she says to me, please just let me get on the stand. Wow. And I said, okay. She got up there and I'm telling you, Ben, the whole courtroom changed. And all she talked about, and she was on and off in 15 minutes, was what it takes for her to change our clients' clothes in the morning. And she had no agenda. She had no stake in the matter. But the jury was transfixed and we were transfixed. And so one thing that I have learned, particularly in complex cases, is yes, you have to get into the complexity because you got to get your burden of proof, but find a way to bring it home to the jury and use regular people if you can. And they get that. They get that. That's what I've looked at. And the farther I've gone in my career, and I hate to say this, but the more I think medical malpractice is not about the medicine, it's about explaining what really happened here.
Yeah, it's an interesting observation that I think most people that have become very skilled at doing medical malpractice cases make is that it isn't about the medicine, and this is mostly what I do as well. But I think what happens is it's that you become so conversant in the medicine and you master it. And then only once you've done that can you make it about something else, because you've mastered it to the point you can simplify it.
Yeah.
Whereas before you master it, you're still grappling with the medicine and, you know, you're going to lose that battle in the trenches of the medicine, probably most of the time. But I worry that when experienced trial lawyers tell new lawyers it's not about the medicine, it isn't for you anymore because you've now mastered the medicine. But you can't shortcut that either and just go into a Med-Mal case and get your head handed to you on the medicine, because that also doesn't work. You know,
you're 100% right. And I'll tell you again, going back to Bruce, and I'll never forget it. It's rung true for me my whole career. Is the very first day he scared me because he said, you need to know every page of that medical record. And I was like, how can you do that? And you really do that. But you're right. You just can't skip over that hard work side of things, particularly in medical cases, because they're not car accidents. And there's going to be a million rabbit holes. And sometimes you have to go down them. And sometimes you have to know when to come back out of them. That makes it more difficult.
So you've got a wife, young children, you're doing a very demanding and high stress career. How do you manage to keep it all together and keep yourself fit, stress-free enough and sane enough to try cases for a living?
I guess you'd have to ask my wife and kids if I've done that.
No, we'll have them on next time to rebut you.
Right. Yes, yeah, exactly. I mean, it's all about balance. So working out is my thing. I've always been really into that and I am religious about it. I never miss those.
And do you do that even in the middle of trials? You're still working out?
I do. It's a week. I call it the week workout. It's a go down to elliptical in a hotel room for 20 minutes. But I do it. And I'm a big outdoors guy. We have a house here in Virginia at a lake and that's just my place of refuge. And so going down on there on weekends and taking a look at the lake, and whether it's chopping firewood or building a fort, I got little kids. That's where I get my pleasure from. I focus hard to keep a balance. As you know, it's not easy. In terms of for instance, 3 days a week, luckily my kids go to school half a mile from our house. We walk to school together. And I got to be honest with you, half the time I'm like, oh, I got to get to the office. But then when I get to the office, I realize just having that time with them makes a difference. And the other thing, your kids are older, there's nothing better than coming home after a crappy day, stressed out, and your kids could care less, right? And my son wants to show me his latest Lego project, and my daughter wants to show the pillow fort that she's built. And you're like, okay, I got it. There's more important things than this. So for me, it's always been, the exercise has been the big thing for me. And then just having perspective. one of the things I will say, maybe you can agree with me or disagree with me, but doing med mal, you're going to lose your share of cases. And
I've mastered that part of the practice, believe me.
I have too. And I'll tell you too, I always say this, the low from losing is so much lower than the high from winning. It's just so every true. Single case, right?
Yeah.
And so just realizing that you give it your hardest, but you can only move that ball so far and taking that in stride. And the other thing is meditation. My wife's got me into meditation now, which I kind of like. I've never done it before, but it's pretty cool.
It's pretty good. We actually do it as a law firm. We've implemented it and we do it every day.
Really?
Usually right around noon. But anybody who's available, we do it for 12 minutes. And
yep.
It's a great thing. People really enjoy it. A nice reset in the middle of the day.
100%. So. Yeah, I do this. It's this Calm app. It's a 10-minute meditation. And yeah, it's great. Yeah.
Well, Scott, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. We really appreciate it. Learned a lot. And congrats on all of your success. And looking forward to hearing about future success down the road.
Ben, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. And it's been a really great experience. Thank you.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.